Next episode of the CMO Suite is brought to you by Connectivity Holdings. People want to do business with brands they know, like, and trust. What's changed is how you connect to them. Connectivity Holdings, helping brands do just that. Because if you don't stand for something, you stand for nothing. Find out more at connectivityholdings.com.
Coming up this episode, it's Bon and Beau with Bon and Ventures.
You're in the CMO Suite, the podcast for marketers who want to be in the know, presented by Connectivity Holdings.
Hello, I am your host, Sean Halter, and welcome to the CMO Suite. With me today is my co-host, Stacey Horton. It is lovely to have you here. We are still in New York City, and I am incredibly excited because we have with us our guest. We've waited almost the entire week for him. It is Bonnet.
Hi, how are you guys?
Wow, we are good. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Suite. Talk to us a little bit about kind of how you got started in this business. And I want to preface this by saying that your Instagram handle is just your first name. That's when you know somebody is like IG famous, Stacey, when their Instagram is just their first name. So it's at Bonin, B-O-N-I-N.
Bonin.
How did you end up with just the one name? Because you were an early
just
adopter?
Yeah, I was an early adopter.
You're like...
I was, you know, it's so far, I was early on Twitter, Instagram. Now, the question was I an early user? Yeah. I was actually initially on Instagram. I was at Bao B, which is, you know, my last name, first initial. And then we switched it over to Bonin, but we were early enough that nobody had Bonin.
And Twitter, I feel like I was talking to Rich Antoniello the other day. He's such a huge Twitter guy.
I think I'm actually still at Bao B on Twitter.
Yeah.
I have to check.
Are you ever on it? Do you do your own social postings or do
yeah,
you have
of
others
course.
Who do
yeah.
everything for you?
Yeah. Well, on my phone, I don't even realize that I'm just posting. Yeah. But I think that I'm positive I'm at Bao B actually. But because we couldn't get Bonin, there's somebody been squatting on it for a long time.
Yeah.
Apparently Twitter doesn't feel that. I am
worthy of
worthy enough to get it.
How big do you think you need to be worthy enough?
I don't know, man. I guess.
What's the process?
100,000 more. No, well, I knew people there. You know, I was one of Twitter's largest advertiser buyers. I thought, but you know, church and state, so good for them.
Is that the goal for us for 2019? Is to get you verified?
yes, sure. Let's take that. Okay. Let's take on that
We've
challenge.
Set a bar.
Yes,
listen,
exactly. I don't want to set it too high.
I'll
let's
take
not go crazy here.
We don't need
verification.
Verification. That's it.
I don't know if anybody would really verify me. That's what's making me nervous.
Well, why wouldn't they want to? You're a voice. You're a voice of a generation.
I mean,
aren't
have
you?
A voice. I don't.
Listen,
yeah, just like Pepsi is. You know,
Instagram
choice.
Has done it to some extent. I mean,
fair enough.
You're at Bonin.
LinkedIn.
Somebody needs
you know.
To do this.
I just got one more platform. That's my life's goal, my friend. One more platform.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up here in New York City, actually. I actually grew up not too far from here, so on 17 East 17th Street. It's interesting. My dad grew up in the South Side of Chicago, was a musician around 32. He left Chicago. Some things happened there. Got really hot out there. So he moves to New York, and he takes up photography, learns to become a photographer, meets a guy named Phil Niblock. My mom... was much younger. My dad's 91, still alive. Unfortunately, my mother's no longer. Crazy. My mom, who was a much younger woman then, much younger than him as well. She,
props. My dad.
Hey, I mean, I don't. I mean, hey.
I don't know. Anyway,
longer story. So,
yes.
My dad begins to adjunct lecture at the College of Staten Island, where oddly he retired as chair after many other teaching or a number of other. More prominent teaching, or I shouldn't say that, other teaching gigs.
Yeah.
At more known schools, I guess, let's say. And she was a lab assistant, and they met there. She was in love with photography and clearly in love with eventually in love with a photographer. I was born in a 1,500 square foot studio on 17 East 17th Street, and then they moved later, about a year later. To a 5,000 square foot studio on 78 Fifth Avenue.
So you've been New York born, raised,
my whole
really,
life.
Your whole life.
My and, whole life. I've lived in every borough.
And as you moved kind of into marketing and you moved into working with some different companies, did you always stay in
always
New York?
Always stayed in New York.
And so this is base. This is it.
I've lived in China. I've lived in Brazil. I've lived in India, but always, you know, I had a closet here, so to speak.
And so as you come up, you get into the marketing game to some extent. I know you spent some time at Pepsi, correct?
Well, I become a programmer very young. I go to college, open up a web company, two web development shops at my college roommate. We sell both of those. I leave. I was physics poli sci major. I was supposed to go into political philosophy at Columbia. Had a degree that summer. I decided I wanted to make a little bit of money, start freelance programming. It's 1999, and it's the boom of the internet. And I go to a party, and there's like vodka fountains and shrimp boats. And I'm like, forget about grad school. Let's do this for a little bit. And I end up at that time, the largest privately held public relations agency in the world. They wanted to build a digital shop, brought a guy over from RGA. We built that shop. He never wanted to travel. He had little kids. So I did all the global travel and pitching. I opened up San Francisco, Europe, Asia. And I was super young at the time. So young, I used to have to lie to clients about my age.
Did the fact that you came up, in essence, through PR, do you feel like that still is woven into the fabric of who you are to some extent?
What's interesting is two things. So one is we were a pure digital shop. So it was the bust eventually, and we had a lot of pharma clients. So, you know, what sells in recessions, drug, sex, rock and roll. And so we maintained a lot of clients. In fact, at one point in time, we were the largest creator of intranets, if anybody remembers what that is, in the world. And because we were picking up all the other people's clients. But I would say about 70% of our business was separate, completely separate from our PR agency. So we were a true digital shop. I ran tech. I was strategy and architecture, information.
You were everything you needed.
We were a big shop. But I did learn something from PR quite a bit, which was, so I move into, I go to IPG to join the investment group where we did like the first Facebook investment. And then they asked me to build the digital practice for Weber Shandwick. Slightly different, much more integrated into the PR agency than a standalone digital shop. Today, I still think the largest global PR, I doubled the group. But it was interesting because what I learned at RF was, you know, that if I watched them take somebody who was a senior director, basically the CEO, by managing his internal and external communications. And as I became more of an executive, or as I became older, it became important, and I applied a lot of those lessons to.
And those lessons carry through today. I mean, you spent some time
Pepsi,
there,
and
then
I leave
you were at
Pepsi,
and then did you go to Mondelez right after that?
Well, technically Kraft, but I knew it was going to be Mondelez. So yes, I was chief media and e-commerce officer for Kraft.
And so Mondelez. In that job, when you went, once you ended up at Kraft and Mondelez,
okay,
is that where you feel like you kind of, I don't want to say cut your teeth, because obviously you've cut your
PepsiCo.
Teeth. Pepsi, that was it. Yeah. And is that where you feel like you really started forming some good long-term relationships with people that obviously you still even have relationships today? I use that.
No.
So you just feel like that's just at every stop?
You know what? Yeah, every stop. But the real place was I always bet on people really early. So I look back, like the CEO and founder of TubeMogul, we're still really good friends. So to be fair, my first time at South By was maybe 22 years ago or 20 years ago, I guess. We won.
You could buy a house there for, you know, cheap back then.
When I first was going there, so we won People's Choice Award for a thing we did called Mr. Picasso Head, and that was where I went to. When I was going there, they didn't even use the entire convention center for Interactive. It was like a quarter of the convention center was used. It was so tiny.
You were going to say something about the TubeMogul guy.
So I met him my very first South By, and we started working together early. I guess not my first, but one of my first ones. And I bet on him early. I remember meeting the Pure Volume guys. I mean, I bet on people really early, and I think in introducing them to clients. And when I came over to Pepsi, it was no different. We were the first sponsors of Social Media Week, the Shorty Awards. So many things.
I mean, so when you say you bet on people early, do you still? They don't have to be young though. Like you could bet on.
Bet
of something,
on new ideas.
Well, let me think of something hypothetical. Like a 49-year-old guy whose club age is 38, who's building out a podcast or something. I know some people that are like that. I mean, I don't know if you do, but
You know, I'm not really at liberty to answer that question right now. I bet on ideas. Concepts.
Yeah.
It's definitely people, but it's ideas. Like who's doing something that's going to move the world forward, and how can I be the fuel to help make sure that the idea gets out there? I had dinner last night with Mark Sternberg from Brand Innovators. When I was at Mondelez, I said, I want to do something that highlights internal entrepreneurs, and I was calling them intrapreneurs, which is now a well-used word. And I called up Mark and said, hey, let's go to South By. He's like, oh, I don't know. South By seems like it's a big show. It's going to cost a lot. I said, don't worry. I'm going to write the check. And we built that South By Southwest experience. The first one was called Entrepreneurs. I brought Entrepreneur Magazine in. We built that. Or South By. So at one point in time, I was the largest sponsor for almost 10 years of South By Southwest. But when I very first sponsored, first when I was on the agency side, I tried to get clients to do it. Nobody would do it. So when I went over to Pepsi, Clearly, I'm not good enough to sell it. When I went over to Pepsi, that's the very first thing I did. And that first sponsorship, where you did all three festivals, music, film, and interactive, and six brands for $150,000. Yeah. There was no non-endemic sponsor. We were the very first, not LinkedIn, not Microsoft sponsor there. We created Fast Company Grill. We created CNN Grill. Early is interesting.
Early is interesting. So let's take that. That's a great point. Early is interesting. Bet on people. At the same time, people bet on you. And what I'm saying from that perspective is the fact that, you know, if you've never seen, if people have never seen you speak, you have to come. You soak up the air in the room. People come and they see you and they kind of gravitate to you to some extent. But it's beyond the places that you've worked. It's beyond the things that you've done. There is something about you that people find both very personable, somewhat approachable to some extent. And again, maybe it's the fact that you were also an early adapter in some ways of personal brand. And so that may sound cliche, or people may feel like that's just somebody who is always patting themselves on their back. But the reality is, if you're not doing the work, you can talk about yourself all that you want. It's others that talk about you. It's others that are saying, oh, you know him, you know, Cynthia Chen or Cindy Chen, as you get to call her because you're friends with her, right?
I think she called herself that, but go ahead.
Listen,
yeah.
I have to call her
Cynthia. Her mother named her Cynthia, so I'm going to call her Cynthia.
I have to call her Cynthia, you know, at least for now. Yeah. But it's somebody like that, a Cynthia Chen, who's, global for General Mills and works
CEO
in China.
CEO of China.
It's crazy. That's a person who, because I'm saying, hey, I'm interviewing Bon, and she's reaching out to me saying, well, what's he doing? People look. I think people are looking always to kind of see, what are you up to? Because you're an early better, but you're an early winner probably as well.
I like to think sometimes we win. There's a lot of losses too, but you know, I also bet on people inside. Talent is, look, I read a quote in 99 in Harvard Business Review. In fact, I have every single print magazine since that day.
Get your pens out. Here comes
that
the quote.
It says, the mark of a great number one is where their number two goes to lead. And if you don't wake up every single day to try to make sure that the people who are around you are better than you, then you're never going to win. And you know, I used to run an event called Brand You, which was a talent accelerator. And the whole idea was, give me 2 days of your life so that we can focus on you and your career and how you're going to grow your career. And if you look at talent, I was huge on talent. We used to give a huge piece called Talent is the New Black. And when that person was like, talent is black, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to stand up and say that. No, talent is the new black. So change your name. Anyway, and really investing in talent entrepreneurship was about building the programs. We did Pep 10, a bunch of those things. But it's interesting because when I look at the people who I have been blessed to have work with me, I was talking to Mark about this too, in terms of the 40 under 40, Laura Henderson, you know, Cindy Chen, Josh Karp, Dave Wiener, Lauren Fleischer. The names are just like on and on and on and on. And those are all, look, Jamie Soper. I mean, these guys are in like massive positions, and I feel very blessed to have work with them.
It's like the Trailblazers Club.
It's the Trailblazers Club. But the thing I always did, like, I would make sure, yes, I'm on stage, but I would bring my whole team on stage. We brought the whole organization. Yeah. In fact, when I launched Fearless with at Mondelez, the whole idea of the concept was, let's highlight our people, put them on stage, allow them. I always say, look, I want rock stars. I want rock stars. And people are like, rock stars, that's not right, rock stars. I said, no. You can wake up and say you want to be a rock star, but guess what? You have to learn. You have to play some kind of instrument. You have to have some real
take the reps. You
talent.
Take the, yeah.
You have to have talent, dude. Yeah. Like talent. And even more than just having talent, rock stars are people who put stuff into the world that move the world forward.
That's a good point.
And so that's what I want. I want people who are talented and can move the world forward, who can actually execute.
I think if I can jump in for a second, and it's nice because you help fill these, which is great. So
The voids?
Well, the voids, or just the fact that, again, you've got so much that's in there. And so it's great to see you. It's always great to hear you. It's great to see you speak. If you don't walk away with one or two or three things that make you feel like I need to tweak what I'm doing because I'm selling and I'm not solving, that to me, I feel like you were an early adapter of that for me. I was talking to somebody earlier this morning. I'm going to soliloquy for just a second and give you some props. I saw you last year. Mm-hmm. Saw you last year, Adweek event. I'm not going to lie. I'm an old white guy. I didn't know you. I didn't know your brand. But when you walked in that Adweek event and everybody kind of congregated to you, I was like, okay, I need to know who this person is. It's like the line at the theme park, right? Where everybody's waiting in the line and you're like, what ride is this, right? I'm not equating you to a theme park ride. but at the same time, my point to you is this. Once somebody's seen you speak, once somebody has heard things that you say, if you don't walk away with something, then they weren't listening. Fair?
Yeah, or just wasn't saying anything interesting.
Well,
No. But no, it's fair. I think the reality is, I love that you just said that you're selling versus solving, because that's one of the biggest things.
Or you want to solve, not sell.
Sorry. Yes, you want to solve, not sell. I think that's one of the biggest challenges is that people forget what's on the other side of the table. And, you know, if you're not solving people's real core problems, then you're not actually doing yourself a service or them a service. It's a very selfish approach.
Most of us are not doing that. And so my point to you was, after leaving that, right, my poor team's back home, because every time I go to one of these events, they know their phone is going to blow up and I'm going to send, you know, we need to be doing this or 50 more of this. But I think what I left from seeing you there is I left with that mantra. I left the mantra of, we need to blow everything up that we think is marketing, which marketers are horrible marketers, most of us. We're horrible. You know, it's like going again to the house with the painter and his house is painted horribly because he's not actually, you know, he's too busy doing business. So we went back, we blew everything up. We were like, this is ridiculous. We're sending out one sheets, nobody cares. We're sending out case studies, who cares about that? You're trying to talk to CMOs who have problems and you're so busy pitching, you're not trying to think and sit with them and go, what do you actually need help with? If I can connect you to somebody you need help with, then everything else will come in its place. And whether you know that that's the mantra that you give off or not, that's what I took away from that. And it at 49, 48 at the time, you're never too old or too late to change your game, to change it up.
I never thought that. You're never too late to change. And I think that change is what continues to drive you to be better. Like, I was sitting in China writing a book. I had probably what would be arguably one of the better jobs in the marketing world. We ran $3 billion of buying, seventh largest buyer in the world. We were growing our e-com business from 65 to 265 million.
You could probably get tickets to pretty much most of the things.
You can go to anything you want on planet Earth. And I was watching WeChat grow and saying to myself, okay, I've seen this movie before, whether it was the internet, email, social, human attention runs, and then the industry finally follows. And I said, I want to be a part of that wave of that next wave of messaging. And I met this guy, Michael Loeb, who, if some of you don't know, he has the house in billions, but he actually got fired from his job for coming in with a really good idea, at least what he thought, and they fired him. So he created that and turned that into a business. He was at Sports Illustrated Time Inc. Turned that into a business, which became the largest magazine retail in the world. They ended up buying it back for a little under $1 billion. At the same time, he incubated a tiny company called Priceline. So for getting fired from coming up with a good idea, he now owns a house that's in billions. I met him at his house, and I said, what's your biggest regret? He said, not betting on myself early. And I said, here's my idea. What should you do? He said, well, two things. One, can you get the same job that you have tomorrow? And I said, probably. He said, two, you have some money so that you can. I said, look, I don't have a house that's in billions, which is, by the way, not impressive. When your house is in trillions, then call me. Everybody's got a B behind their name. So, but I can scrounge up a few dollars. He said, quit. And he said, I'll do you one even better. I'll give you a chair and if you need one. And so I quit until this day, 2 years later, a little over 2 years later, we still office in Loeb, NYC. It's been the hardest thing and the best thing that I've ever done, and it was a massive change. In between there, we had a stint where, you know, we helped a business sell for another business sell for a little under $1 billion, which was good. But we have a bunch of emerging startup companies that are, you know, changing what I believe kind of A, the messaging space, but B, direct to consumer. You saw our BreadBot machine, you know, which I think is going to be the future of retail or one of the beginnings. And but at the same time, it's, you know, yeah, you don't, getting tickets is a lot harder.
Sure. But bet on yourself is a good point. I want to make sure we get time for BreadBot, because that's a crazy thing that you're doing in Bonaventures. The point that you made, though, again, of leaping out, you know, if you can build yourself a little bit of
new muscles today than I had 2 years ago that I've never had.
And doesn't it feel more rewarding?
Some days, except when you look at payroll.
Yeah.
You're like, these people got to get paid too?
They do. Okay. But at the same time, money, at least for right now, if we don't drive this economy into the you know what, money's still cheap. And this is giving you a chance to build something that you can use all of your skill sets wrapped around.
Money is cheap. the hardest thing is time. And it's not even time like that I want to spend on doing stuff. The only thing I care about is spending my time with the people who are building the businesses that I believe in. Because I feel every single day where I'm with one business over the other, I feel bad that I'm not with the other business, because I know that if I can just give one more minute, one more, you know, that we could get that much further.
Yeah.
And so that's the toughest thing for me is, you know, it's like they're all your kids and you want to go to every single, you know, wrestling meet. But you know,
there's many.
But you also know some are better wrestlers. No, I'm just kidding.
There's many that feel that on a smaller scale. So it's great to know that no matter how either big you get or what size you get or how you leap into this game, that's always there. It's time is your hardest commodity. So speaking of that, we've got 8 minutes left. I want to hit two things for you if I can. We're going to pack a lot in this half an hour. I want to talk about Cleveland Hustle.
Yeah, sure.
And I want to talk about BreadBot. So talk about Cleveland Hustle first, if you don't mind.
I'm going to talk about four things, actually. So Cleveland Hustle, whole idea was to revitalize neighborhoods. We did it with LeBron, and we basically took entrepreneurs that were willing to build storefronts in local neighborhoods that were run down. And in 2016, after the show, we created 80 jobs. We built four businesses. We deployed $1 million in capital. $2 million came in as a result of that. And there was an article written in 2016 in the New York Times that talked about the great work that we've done and how the neighborhood continues to grow. So Cleveland Hustles, you can watch it. We'll be coming back with another season, different place. So we're excited about that.
Why Cleveland?
Because, I mean, you know, certain people who are part of the show happen to like that area of the country.
Great.
All right. So BreadBot. So I meet these guys in Coeur d'Alene, Iowa. Sorry, Idaho. We have another company out of Iowa, actually, female-led. Amazing. Idaho, and they come up to me, and they show me this machine. They go, what do you think? And I said, oh, that's interesting. They show me. They start to talk to me. And what I found phenomenally interesting is that most people in the U.S. as well, don't have access to fresh bread. The bread they buy is shelf-stable, even if they buy it at the bakery, and it's warmed up. It's usually two-thirds of the way frozen before the bakery actually heats it up. So here now you have a machine. From the moment the mix is put in, 101 sensors take over, measure the perfect amount of mix for a loaf, the water, the yeast, take it through the mixing process, the kneading process, the rising process, the baking process, all in front of your face. So talk about true transparency, better ingredients, no preservatives, and every 6 minutes a fresh loaf of bread comes out, so the consumer for the first time can actually buy fresh bread at scale at grocery, not to mention the health impact that that has, but also bringing production back to local neighborhoods. On the flip side, the retailer. So the economics of bread is a loss leader. Most retailers make around 10 cents on average on a loaf of bread. There's a little bit of cost for the mix, a lot of cost for the baking, a ton of cost for distribution, a little bit of cost for the labor once the bread makes it to the store. So we cut two-thirds of that out, give you a better product, and we take the average profitability from 10 cents to anywhere from $2 and $2.50, which means that the retailer makes a 25x increase on opportunity, but also gets to deliver that cost savings to the consumer. So we're delivering a quality product for cheaper than anybody else. Usually we increase premium bread purchase about 40% when we're in the store. And the stores that we've been in, 50% of the bread sold in the total bread category ends up being ours because consumers get a better product.
You know your numbers.
I do know my numbers. Next, we have a baby food business called Tiny Organic. So the other crazy thing is, if you look, baby food was created in 1938. There hasn't really been an innovation since the last 10 years with the pouch. Pouches are great, but many have been on the shelf longer than your baby's been born. If you look, there's only one refrigerator. Once you leave pouches, or in some cases we recommend even foregoing them, and you reach the finger food stage, there's really nothing in the aisle today. And so that's what we are. We are fresh finger food, totally organic. It teaches your baby dexterity. We have, if you actually look at what is there, it's Puffs, which are Cheetos for the most part, Go-Gurt, which is two cans of soda, and Cheerios, which we love, but not a lot of diversity. We have diversity of palate. We have a chef from Noma, per se, La Bernardin, so cooking things like baby borscht, cooking baby burrito bowl, apple pie oatmeal, really palate expansive, great tasting food that even you would eat. The crazy thing is our dogs eat better than our babies do today. And so we're transforming that. 10% of Park Slope moms today eat our food, and hopefully over 3% of the East Coast will eat our food by the end of this year. Last business.
Hold on. Let me just squeeze one question in. I know we still have a few seconds. Do you feel like your transforming the world to some extent, which is more rewarding than having a big title at a big company.
The fact
by doing what you're doing right now.
The baby food business, and also it's text to buy and text to talk. So moms, you know, one of the biggest challenges is information for mom hasn't been reinvented since Baby Center. So again, it's Tiny Organics, and then you can text us and talk to an infant nutritionist, talk about your challenges with raising a child. We don't realize how hard it is. There's so much information all the way, what to expect when expecting, and then, oh, you're 9 months. But the moment you leave the hospital with that little
thing. You're on your own.
You're on your own.
All right. You wanted to hit one more thing.
Open message. So open message is the future of messaging. So conversational commerce meets visual design for messages. And so basically what it is the ability for us to move out of the dark ages of gray bubbles and black text, which 1995, that was when the first message was sent. We dynamically generate visually beautiful messages that are great for DTC, for publishing, for loyalty platforms and programs, and then we create conversational commerce. So you can literally buy product right inside of text, huge text to buy application, and ultimately a next big wave, and we believe the future. And we're agnostic from platforms. So most people are doing bots and Messenger. We're agnostic from Messenger to WeChat to WhatsApp to text. By the way, 2.8 trillion messages sent from business to consumers today. They're all gray with black text. We fix that, but even more, they go unmonetized.
We've done a horrible job.
So we monetize them. Okay.
2.5 minutes.
Go ahead.
I have 2.5 more minutes with you. What do you wish you knew more about? What's the thing this year that you're like... you wish you could see ahead.
What is in the future? No, I like the journey. What do I wish I knew more about? I wish I spent more time in space.
In space, like actual.
Yeah. So I promised myself that by 50, my retirement career would be space tourism. And to be honest with you, I don't feel like. We're laying the groundwork from an investment standpoint in these businesses, but I don't know if I'm closing the knowledge gap. I used to be on the board of a company called Made in Space, which was the first 3D printer to print in space. And so I felt close and I used to be able to go. I was a young astronaut growing up.
Have you met Elon?
I met Elon. I've also met Buzz Aldrin, which I love Elon, but Buzz is a little bit more of a. I've met Buzz like 4 times, and every single time I'm like a little kid. Click, click, click.
The best Buzz Aldrin, if you Google him on YouTube, I think some guy was stalking him to get a picture, an autograph, or something crazy like that. And finally, I think he literally like looked at him and just gave him a smack. And that's when you knew, like, okay, Buzz Aldrin is not screwing around. Don't waste his time.
Buzz is—he's pretty prolific, and he's been—I mean, he's an older gentleman, and he's—I see him a lot.
This was
places.
Like last year.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
He's got to be pushing like 75.
That's my—you know—like I might not be able to ever walk on the moon, but I hope I can get to space
and
I touch
Elon
the
Musk.
Moon. Yeah, yeah. I actually have.
You smoked with Elon Musk? Am I allowed to ask that? Never mind. All right, I'm going to stay away from that. I'm staying away from that.
Cannabis, I guess that's the next.
Oh my gosh. Right?
We didn't even talk about it. That's the next big challenge.
Next big challenge.
I think it's the next big that. And I also think that there's something interesting happening in the vaping space, which, you know, we don't have a chance to talk about, which is I think that we're about to have 1/7 of the human population who are currently combustible smokers transition from combustible smokers, which is the second largest killer of people. And people think I'm controversial for talking about this, over to something that's going to be far greater and probably one of the largest impacts of public health. And instead of purely scrutinizing the industry, we need to make sure that the industry has the right regulations to help transition what is one of the largest killers on planet Earth.
That's it. That's our time. 30 minutes with you. Thank you so much for all of the time. You can find out more about him on LinkedIn. You can stalk him like I did.
You can text me, 646-759-1837.
Say that one more time, because people literally can text you.
You can text me right now. You can text me, or you can buy the book called Text Me. But my number is 646-759-1837.
The genius, the man, what else?
Well, no, I was going to say, if you send me a text, 646-759-1837, you put hashtag CMO Suite, CMO Suite, we will send you a free digital copy of the book.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for hanging out in the CMO Suite. The podcast for marketers who want to be in the know. Presented by Connectivity Holdings.
You're a C-level manager. You shouldn't have to know the difference between behavioral or contextual targeting, but your agency should. Uconnects provides brands and biddable teams direct access to platforms like The Trade Desk, Google, Amazon, Facebook, OTT, and more. Their U.S.-based traders can train your in-house team or provide complete transparency with no minimums and CPM-based service pricing for true transparency. Something Mighty Hive, The Trade Desk, and Centro simply don't offer. Tired of being the smartest one in the room? Reach out to Uconnex today for a free demo. Uconnex, the world's leader in true, transparent, biddable media.